This is Beyond a Reasonable Doubt with your hosts, Mark Garagus and Gary Smith.
Gary, welcome. The Altar of Bard on Sunday. Quite a good time and quite a week we've had. You and I seem to be both kind of in the Murdaugh trial mode. So without further ado, why don't we get in on it? You want to do kind of a summary of where we're at this week, or you want to just dive right in?
Summary of where we're at is they're still going through the witness list, right? I think that both sides are doing a decent job. In my opinion, the defense is looking pretty compelling. You know, Dick's done a good job of finding, you know, small things and making them seem like bigger things. I thought that he did a number on the investigator who collected the cell phone and apparently put it in what she described like a sandwich bag. And he wanted to know why a Faraday bag wasn't used, and just little things like that, where he is able to really
speak to you. That really do speak to you, right?
It does. I mean, look, if there's a double murder investigation, you're putting the cell phone in question, which is arguably the most data intensive device anyone carries, into a paper bag and throwing it in the SUV and headed back to headquarters. I don't know. I feel like I would expect better.
So what I think is happening right now is if you see the clips from the courtroom, it's not easy to tell just if you're a casual observer. Is this witness testifying in front of the jury or just in front of the judge? And then what the judge has done is, because there is just so many counts involved in this case, and frankly, I don't understand why they haven't severed this case. And what I mean by that is, you've got a murder case, number one, and then you've got all of these financial crimes that are alleged, and they're being tried together. And part of the dance that the judge has to do is decide what evidence can come in for the murder that won't be unduly prejudicial, because it's also relevant to the financial crimes. Because you don't want, under the law, you don't want somebody to be convicted just because he's a thief, to make people have the idea that, well, if you did those crimes, you must have committed the murder. Right. So there's been a bunch of hearings that have been done during the trial, because there is a jury that's in the box. But they will do what are normally called in camera or out of the presence of the jury proceedings. Some of these are, some of these aren't. The judge is going to be making some of those calls on tomorrow, as we tape this on Sunday. And so one of the first ones, I think, is this so-called confession to his best friend, which we, I think, have got a clip of. Yeah, here it is.
Did y'all have a conversation?
We did.
Where was the conversation?
I got there before he did. I don't think I pulled in the driveway. I kind of waited out on the road. Pulled in the driveway. We went in the side door. The caregiver was there. We went out onto the front porch, and we talked on the front porch.
And what did he say to you?
I mean, the first thing I asked him was, you know, Alec, what the H is going on here? You know, what is going on? And have you done something else to me or that involves me that I don't know about? Because I know about this and I've got to deal with this, but is there something else you've done that I don't know about that I need to be concerned with?
And what did he say?
He broke down crying. Said I can't write this second. He went inside, came back out with some paper towels, and told me that he had had a drug problem, that he was addicted to opioids, and that he had been addicted for, I don't remember if he said 20 or 20 plus years, but for 20 years or so.
Did he say anything about the money?
He told me that he had been stealing money.
Did he have a particular phrase about what he had done to you?
Shit me up.
He said he shit you up?
Shit me up, or shit me up, or shit me off, or something like that, but I think it was he'd shit me up.
Said that he admitted to you he had been stealing client money?
Yes, sir.
So he confessed that to you, is that correct?
He said he had shut a lot of people up.
I'm going to show you what's been marked as States 313 in this in-camera hearing. Do you recognize that?
Yes, sir.
What is that?
I think this is the original of that $225,000 fee check written in the gentleman's case directly to Richard Alexander Murdoch, Esquire.
Is that your signature on it?
It is.
Yeah, so, by the way, you know, the ship me up, quite an expression. I betray my lack of knowledge of South Carolina slang.
Yeah, I was confused by that as well, but apparently it wasn't confusing.
Ship me up.
Yeah, apparently Chris knew what it meant.
Yeah, he knew exactly what it meant. So this was part of the in-camera hearing outside the presence of the jury, which I believe, don't hold me to this, but I believe will be decided tomorrow morning as to whether that is going to come in, because obviously that is a confession or admission as to the financial crimes. But should that be allowed in, because it would unduly prejudice him as to the murder? And, you know, the prosecution obviously wants this to be, as you and I have discussed, they want this to be the motive for this. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, it certainly doesn't look good to have the gentleman's best friend of 25 years up there talking about how, you know, Murdoch screwed him over. It's certainly not going to be something that the defense, I think, would be happy with. But with that said, you know, as you pointed out, they want to separate the financial crimes. And there's another clip that we have that I please educate me if I'm incorrect, but when I was reviewing it, I got the impression that maybe this was also outside the presence of the jury, because the judge asked specifically whether or not the prosecution is looking to question somebody, one of the potential witnesses, about financial crimes or about the murders.
Yeah, exactly. So let's play that, because it kind of dovetails exactly as you put it together.
Can you be more specific as to what you're talking about, Mr. Waters?
From my understanding, there was a meeting or some sort of gathering in which Mr. Griffin and Mr. Murdoch and then a number of other individuals were present, in which the defendant made some statements. The contents.
Individuals?
No. I think some of his partners and other individuals, maybe some family, to which I have never been privy to the contents. However, I would like to know the contents, but I've been careful out of an abundance of caution not to ever become privy until I had a ruling from the court that there was no attorney-client privilege because of the presence of third parties to that conversation. So I would like to address that with the court, and if the court believes that and rules that there is no attorney-client privilege, then I may, at the appropriate time, examine people who were present at that conversation as to what the defendant said.
And is that in relation to financial crimes or?
No, sir. That would be in relation to the murders of Maggie and Paul. But it is an in-camera matter that if we have the time available, I wanted to raise that with the court. Maybe we can go ahead and knock that one out as well.
All right. Any thoughts by the defense?
Your Honor, what he's referring to is, it was on Thursday, June the 10th, when Sled came to John Marvin Murdoch's hunting property to interview Alec, to interview John Marvin Murdoch, Randy Murdoch, Buster Murdoch, and before I was there to represent Alec for purposes of that. Before Sled got there, we were all in the house. I have no idea what beyond that he's talking about. I mean, what was supposedly said or heard, or I have no idea, but beyond that. But.
So this is kind of an interesting dance that's going on this particular issue. This is also, as you astutely pointed out, outside the presence of the jury. The prosecutor, who was the first gentleman speaking, is making a proffer to the court. And the proffer to the court is, I'm told that there is a conversation that happened, even though it was his attorney present and maybe his partners. So there's other lawyers, but the presence of third parties can eliminate the protection of the attorney-client privilege. So he wants the judge, and he is properly so, the prosecutor has said. I haven't inquired so far about that, meaning he hasn't asked somebody who may have been at that meeting about what was said by Alec Murdoch, because he wants to err on the side of caution, make sure the judge has ruled that there's no attorney-client privilege as to the statements that were made before he elicits them. The defense response was basically, I have no idea what the statements are that he's referring to. So both of them are kind of doing this dance. Prosecutor is saying, I don't know what the statements are. And defense is saying, I don't know what the statements are. Prosecutor is saying, well, before I inquire, I want to make sure I don't step on an IED. And the defense is saying, well, he didn't use the words, but you'll hear it at some point. They're going to argue this is a fishing expedition. If you don't know what was said and you don't have a good faith belief as to what was said, then why are you going to inquire? Because you don't know what it is that you're trying to find out. Judge has got to rule on that first. But this is, interestingly, in trials, this happens all the time. You do these by way of what are called motions in limine, which means, judge, this is a subject matter that I want you to rule on before we get into, because I don't want to have you come back and give me the legal equivalent of a bench slap or a bitch slap and ship me up on this. So that's what the dance is so far.
Yeah. All right. We have two more clips here. And maybe before we get to them, there was something that you had sent me about Dick Harpootlian raising issues with the way the evidence was collected in terms of potential footprints or tire tracks, and the fact that the area around the crime scene was not taped off. So other vehicles, sled vehicles, and, you know, friends and family who arrived were able to drive over them and possibly eliminate any potential, tracks of a third party, of a potential other suspect. One other thing that I had heard in some of the watching I've been doing of the trial is, I believe there was also an issue where when they did take pictures of some of the footprints and some of the tire tracks, they did not include a ruler in that picture, which I believe is the correct best practices for that data evidence collection. And Dick was harping on that pretty strongly, that, you know, the evidence that they do have, there's no way of having scale in it. And I thought that was
Dick harping on it, Harpootlian. I like that. That was a very good use. It's become a theme here, as you've pointed out, starting with the cell phone, the tire tracks, the collection of items, how it was collected. One of the reasons I had sent you that little clip that was kind of a synopsis, I believe, out of the New York Times, they have distilled down what they think is part of the defense theme, if you will, and it clearly is. I mean, the defense theme here is that they had their sights trained on Alec Murdoch. They weren't looking, or did not do enough to look for others. There was a suggestion, you know, that the statement that he made close in time to the murders about he knows what this is about, that it had to do with the boating accident that his son was being prosecuted for.
Right.
And then he immediately said that. You know, it's funny when you take a statement that somebody makes, a defendant makes, and I've had this happen countless times, where you would think that is an obvious, I mean, here you are, you find your son and your wife butchered. You assume for a second that you haven't decided that he is good for it, that you're going to this with an open mind. When you know that the son is being prosecuted, when you know that there are people who believe, and there have been threats, that you as the father have interfered with that prosecution, or that there hasn't been a justice achieved because you've been pulling strings or pulling levers or something like that. Because that was all the lead up to this. So your reaction is, oh my God, who could have done this? This is what, you know, you and I were speculating from afar when this case first started. Was this related to drugs? Was this related to gambling? Was it? I mean, because we came to this without the focus trained on him. So now the prosecution's taken what I would assert is a kind of a normal or expected reaction. They're saying, oh, this is a tidy excuse. This is a tidy alibi or explanation for or deflecting blame. And so there you show the two sides of this. Somebody who comes to it with the idea that he's guilty is going to say, oh, it's just, of course, he had some excuse. And somebody who comes to it with, oh, my God, this is horrific. He couldn't have done it with his healthy skepticism, which, by the way, is aside is the definition of reasonable doubt and what you're supposed to do when you have a presumption of innocence, and says, no, that's what he would have expected. It makes sense given the totality of the circumstances.
Well, one of the reasons that I think that you and I were always looking at drugs and at gambling possibly was the, you know, at the time, we obviously had a lot less information than we did now. But one of the things we did know was that there were two different weapons used, and that, you know, Alec had obviously survived. And, you know, this is a gruesome situation. So we were wondering, you know, what was this a message that was being sent? And some of the testimony this week also had to do with those two weapons. You want to review the clip we have on that?
Yeah, let's go. Because this, for those who don't know, setting this up is there is evidence that not one, but two weapons, and weapons on the property were used in connection with this. And this suggestion is based on ballistic evidence. And here's that sets up for this clip.
Correct. And I'm just going to add also that the prosecution has been trying hard to establish that one of the weapons that was used was a family weapon that had been used months prior, and they collected shell casings that matched. And you're going to hear that testified about here.
And if you'll tell the jury what problems you encountered when you test-fired item 33, which is State's Exhibit 88.
Yes, sir. During test-firing, I loaded the magazine with cartridges. That was sled item 34. And I inserted that into the magazine well of the sled item 33, the rifle. I chambered the first available cartridge into the firearm and fired it. That went as expected. The cartridge was fired. It extracted and ejected from that firearm properly. However, as that bolt was going back forward, I would have expected it to pick up the next available cartridge from the magazine. However, it didn't. And I had to manually cycle that bolt again to load the next available cartridge from the magazine. That issue did not prevent me from test firing it, and I was able to collect those test specimens that I needed, and no further analysis to determine the cause of that was conducted.
So when you say you had to manually, it says as the firearm cycled, the next available cartridge in the magazine failed to feed in the chamber. So then you had to manually do it. How do you manually do it?
Yes, sir. On the top of the firearm, there's a charging handle. I had to pull back on that charging handle, which in turn pulls that bolt backwards. And when I did that and released it, it was able to then go forward on its own and pick up the next cartridge from that magazine that was inserted into the firearm. Okay.
And you had to do that every time you fired Exhibit 88, is that correct?
Yes, sir, I believe so. During my test firing, I did have that phenomenon occur.
So is it fair to say Exhibit 88, item 33, was malfunctioning when you tested it?
Okay, so I was watching a longer version of this testimony, and that was I got confused as to the part about the shells that they've matched. But what this suggests, and what I found unusual here, is that it would suggest that the weapon fired five times successfully before this malfunction came to be, because it would be unlikely when you're attempting to assault two different people that you would manually recharge it five different times. That would be cumbersome, to say the least. So either it was wildly unlucky that it malfunctioned after five, but I believe that the prosecution is going to use this as the reasoning for why two guns were used. They're going to say that the blackout, the assault rifle, failed, and therefore he had to pick up something else to finish the job, right?
Right. And once again, this is how the two sides view this differently. I think the defense is going to run with the idea that, no, this wasn't one person using two guns. This was two people using different guns.
Right.
And Those are, by the way, once again, that goes into, you get jury instructions that say if there are two reasonable interpretations, one pointing towards guilt, one pointing towards innocence, you must adopt the one pointing towards innocence. That's the definition of reasonable doubt.
Well, there's certainly a lot more that will.
And it's also the title of this podcast.
Yes, so. Yes, it is. There's obviously a lot more that'll come out, but this one seems important to me because in the proximity that their theory goes with, that they were all very close to each other. You know, the idea of a weapon malfunctioning and then you being able to stop, get another weapon, and successfully fire it before the surviving victim is able to try to intervene and stop you seems unlikely. I mean,
You run away,
right? I mean, that exactly. Was the, either run at the gunman or run away, and you know, thus right. Be in a different locale. The idea that he fired five shots at one victim, the gun malfunctioned, and he was able to get rid of it, and get a new one before the other victim was able to move really at all seems unlikely.
Right, which is, I think, supports the fact that there were two people there, two shooters at the scene. And one of the problems that we have, obviously, and this is what I assume the defense will argue in the closing, is we won't know the answer to that. We can't know the answer to that because tire tracks, footprints, everything else were not adequately preserved during the investigation. So why does the defense, who does not have the burden of proof, take the brunt of that?
Yeah, absolutely.
So Gary will save the rest of this
great
for Tuesday, I think, if we can hijack Adam into this arena.
We'll try to carve out at least a little corner of the big show on Tuesday to talk more Murdaugh, and we'll get to a lot more as the week unfolds. Mark, thank you so much as always for your time.
Are we doing Adam and Drew this week?
We are, yeah. Well, not for a listener, it will be the week of February 13th that they will air, but you and I are recording Adam and Drew on Monday morning with you filling in for Adam, so everyone, I'm sure, will be looking forward to that.
Thank you, Gary. Good to see you.
Thanks, Mark. Have a great Sunday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. Stay tuned for more bonus episodes coming soon.